The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to this week's Tech Weekly podcast for the week beginning the 3rd of April 2010. I'm Alex Krotowski, and it's with a note of sadness that we record this episode as we are saying goodbye to two very important people in the tech brother and sisterhood here at Guardian Towers. San Francisco-based Bobby Johnson, the voice of reason, rationality, and, as you'll hear later on, the voice of some choice epithets when things go wrong behind the mic, is leaving the fold, as is Kevin Anderson, our man with a finger on the political pulse. Bobby, what are your plans?
I'm going to go and spend some quality time with my iPad, I think. You know, just months of staring at it.
That sounds a little bit dirty, so we'll move on. Kevin, I think you've got a few exciting things up your sleeve.
Yeah, just a few. We're going to go home and spend some quality time with kittens, but also have sort of a world tour for the next couple of months, doing some training and speaking around Europe and maybe the Middle East. And then chill out a little bit and... hopefully, fingers crossed, a new project by the summer.
Charles, what are you going to do with your, with the empty studio? It's going to be you and me for a while, isn't it?
And Jemima. I expect, we'll, in 2 years' time, we'll discover that Kevin is the sort of internet entrepreneur and we'll be insanely envious.
Hey, no. I'm looking to jailbreak some good friends.
Hey. Woohoo. Hiya. Anyway, besides making a nod to the change in personnel on this week's podcast, we'll be looking at two areas where the web is changing entertainment. First up, Keith Stewart will be taking us through the night at the recent X48 Microsoft XNA Game Camp.
It's 3:30 in the morning now. It's actually very, very quiet in the programming room. I thought there would be more arguments and disagreements and sort of crazed behaviour at this time, but everyone seems to be... holding it together quite well.
That was Keith Stewart in Huddersfield at 3:30 in the morning, talking to the game developers of the future. And Charles will be speaking with We7, one of the leading lights in free music, who are surfing the wave of streaming technology that brings tunes, or shall I say tunes, to the masses in a new chapter in the business models of the music industry. All this, plus the latest tech headlines from around the web. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Over the past decade, the music industry, including the musicians themselves and the labels that represent them, have struggled to adapt to the onslaught of peer-to-peer file sharing and piracy, standing like immovable sticks in the mud in the face of wave after wave of spiraling annual results. By dogmatically refusing to adapt to the changing mediascape, they have arguably lost billions. It's only now, with the rise of subscription services like We7, that the tide is beginning to turn. Streaming media services have truly taken off, giving listeners something apparently for nothing in exchange for a few targeted advertisements and giving industry insiders the compensation that keeps the machine working. So what has changed over the past few years that's allowed the listeners to play nicely with the creatives and the business people? Charles Arthur spoke with Steve Purdom, CEO and co-founder of We7, to find out what's inspired this sea change. Now, Charles, tell me a little bit about We7.
Well, We7 was launched as a download service in October 2007, but a year later they shifted over to becoming a streaming service. So you simply went to the site and you could listen to anything, and they would stuff ads into it. It was created by Steve Purdom, and the co-founder is Peter Gabriel, of course, who's been behind a lot of the music sites. They've been seeing a lot of growth in the number of people coming to the website, but really the way forward is to actually start making some direct money out of people and to give them some sort of incentive for paying money, and that's to take away the ads. So I put into him that it was interesting that We7, which is starting a subscription service for the iPhone and on its website, that it was offering the same charges as a subscription for Spotify.
I think it's nothing to do with the Spotify and so on. It's actually more to do with what the world out there is prepared to accept, the consumer, and it seems to be gravitating to online streaming to be around about £5 a month. If you look at We7, you look at Sky Songs, you look at Napster and things like that, it's about that type of level. Once you introduce mobile, the actual freedom that mobile gives you, the ability to take 1,000, 2,000 songs with you on holiday and change them however you want, then that £10 a month is actually the level where most people are saying, oh, actually £2 a week's not bad.
Isn't there, though, an equal problem, which is that you have to pay licensing costs for every track that's played. How do you keep those in line? I mean, if someone is listening offline to these songs and they just leave it on all the time, that's going to leave you in the hole for a lot of revenues.
There's always three things to pay for. There's the cost of the performance, there's the cost of the person who wrote the song, and then there's the cost of delivery. And those are the three components that we have to bear. But they are slightly different in the subscription space. Although there's three components, they are bundled together. So it's not like we're having to pay for every stream. We have to pay for a certain amount of royalty for somebody who has a £5 or a £10 subscription.
But as I understand it, streaming costs are comparatively small compared to the royalty costs. I've seen some numbers looking at these sorts of things, and they suggest that actually it's the royalty cost which is the real thing that hobbles you. Because streaming, you can buy, you know, servers get cheaper, bandwidth gets cheaper as time goes on, but the licensing costs are not falling at all. They don't scale.
And that's why music isn't a freemium model. A lot of people have said that music, like We7, is freemium and other models are like a freemium, but it's not, as you rightly highlight. If I double the number of users, our costs don't go down towards zero. They actually double because of the licensing element of it.
But although you get to serve twice as many ads.
Oh, you get to serve twice as many ads, but you have to make sure that you actually sell more ad revenue than the cost of actually the streaming. So let's just pull the two slightly apart for a second. The ad-funded side, every song that is actually played has a payment that goes to the performer and a payment that goes to the person who wrote the song. And those are the biggest elements of it. It's roughly around about 0.3 to 0.5p is what I would call as a fair and reasonable rate that's actually happening for on demand at the moment. Some models do it differently, and we believe that the ad-funded side will actually get to a point fairly soon where we can prove that ad-funded will pay for the music. When you move into the subscription, although there's still those two components to pay for, they are capped. It's not based upon the number of streams. It's based upon a revenue share to the people who actually performed it and a revenue share to the publishers. So it's not as frightening, you know, just such that one subscriber suddenly listens to 20,000 songs in a month doesn't mean that we have to pay 20,000 the amount for that particular person's subscription. It's controlled in a much different way, in a different way, even though there's still the two components to pay for.
Is We7 profitable?
No, it's not. But actually, one of the exciting things is that a lot of ad-funded music businesses have actually disappeared very quickly over the last two or three years, especially in the States. I mean, Spiral, Frog, La La, I Like The... And the reason why they haven't really survived is because they did the classic internet idea. And we've already talked about that fact. This is music isn't freemium. So they went for scale. And the businesses who have gone for scale and then worried about the economics after the fact ended up owing the music industry a large amount of money. We've been different. We've actually managed our scale. We've focused upon the UK. We now have 3 million users in the UK who listen to the music on a monthly basis. But what we're trying to do is get to the point where the advertising pays for the music, making it add up. And the nice thing about it is that we don't believe we're that far away from that. When that happens, then we can allow scale to happen.
One of the big issues at the moment revolving around music as well is with Parliament and the Digital Economy Bill. If we assume that it goes through in its present form, do you think that will help your business, or will it in some ways perhaps hinder it? Can you see any, you know, pluses, minuses to it?
It'll both help and hinder. The big thing for the music industry around the Digital Economy Bill is the stick. It's the ability to monitor by the ISPs and the ability to threaten the audience with cut-off or letters that actually will identify you're doing something wrong. And where I believe that you do need to have a stick as a backup to everything else that's going on, I really more believe in the education and the telling the 99% of people who don't do things in the wrong way, but they just want to know how to do it the right way, because nobody knows when they go to a website whether it's legal or not. That education by the industry of what is legal and available is actually going to be far better than, I think, the digital economy element of it. The danger with the stick always is you get a backlash. You get people saying, this is not fair. But to both of them together actually start to get the music industry in a position where they can actually have the carrot and the stick, which actually is where everybody wants to be.
There has been a lot of criticism of the record labels about being slow to adjust to the digital economy, I guess, and to and being slow to license, being slow to allow companies like your own to take advantage of the internet. Do you think that that's changing? Are they in a sort of an end stage of evolution now where they really getting it?
I don't think they're at an end stage yet, but it is changing dramatically. I mean, coming from the technology world into the music world 3 years ago, and I went to Midden, one of the big events in the calendar for the music industry, and I was talking about things like ad-funded and free and MP3s, and I was basically the devil incarnate at that point. You know, the answer was no, what was the question? But to be fair, in the last 12, 18 months, you know, the major record labels, the independents, have been very, very supportive.
That was Steve Purdom from We7. Now, Charles, labels have been really slow to change, as Steve mentioned. But he also mentioned that they are now knocking down his door, whereas before he was a pariah just a couple of years ago. What's actually changed in the music industry that's created this transformation?
I think the very big holes in where they used to have profits, actually. I mean, I find it incredible that he's saying that he went to meet them, you know, 3-4 years ago. That's 2006. You know, 2007, and that they were saying no to him. I mean, you know, that's a point where everyone had already said, yeah, there's a whole lot of file sharing going on. There's a whole lot of, you know, the CD sales had fallen off a cliff. You know, music single sales have fallen off a cliff, and yet at that time they're still saying no to him. I mean, clearly the music industry has said, blimey, what happened to all the money? And I think that's the reason, because they're saying that people are going to Spotify, they're going to We7. You know, they are actually interested in, you know, not being illegal, because actually for a lot of people, you know, the idea that you're doing something shady doesn't fill you with a great feeling every day. So I think that's what's changed, is that they've realized that these are legal services, that they want to be legal services, and that they just aren't getting the money they were.
Well, you say that, you know, the music industry recognizes that, you know, these giant holes where they're losing money. But just the other day, I think it was earlier last month, that Keegan wrote a column where he said that the demise of the music industry is visible everywhere but in the facts. He actually argues, Bobby, that that the music industry is one of the few successes within the recession. And I'll just give you a few figures. He says, far from imploding, it's one of the great success stories of the recession. The most dramatic example of this, kids are buying more singles, you know, to the extent that there was a 33% rise in a year when the whole economy contracted by 3.3%. While these kids are downloading free music, Charles, as you said, this may be a reason why they're running towards things like Spotify and We7. These are the kids who are also willing and able to spend £3 on a pop-inspired ringtone. You know, so it seems to me that the music industry isn't necessarily in a recession. So, is this true? Is the music industry actually a great success story because there are more free music tracks out there, because kids are willing to pay subscription models?
Well, I think that's really the point, isn't it? That the music industry is looking at this. Historically, it's looked at it in the same way that it's always seen things. You know, you produce records, you send an artist out to do a tour. And you make money along the way. What they're now realizing is that the money is coming in different places, and if you want to carry on the things that you do, you have to sort of cross subsidize and look at subscription services, at free online radio, at ringtones and all that kind of stuff, and how it feeds back in. I think one of the problems they've always had is when they look at it, the end product they're selling is basically the same regardless whatever service they're using. You know, either you're buying the music, whether that's a download or a CD or whatever, or you're listening to it like you do the radio. And they've sort of approached everything with those two things in mind. And that's where the problems come. I would also point out that streaming music services have been really, I mean, we're getting somewhere with them now, but they've been notoriously terrible at making any money. You look at Last FM, which was founded in 2002 now. That's 8 years since it was founded. It took a couple of years to start getting some traction. Was bought by CBS 3 years ago now for 140 million quid. And they're only just saying that it might start turning profit soon. So, you know, streaming isn't some amazing solution, but it's certainly starting to pick up and actually make a difference.
One of our Twitter readers, one of our listeners on Twitter even, gosh, we can get the whole panoply of media consumption here. Zantiac says, We7 dropped free ad-based download with option of ad-free 30 days later. They're not offering anything different to his current favorite, Spotify. So, Kevin, are there any developments that you can see in the future that don't necessarily rely upon the subscription services that We7 and Spotify and the other services are currently offering?
Well, I think what's interesting is you're actually starting to see different kinds of music companies develop. So Magnatune, for instance, where you can buy a download subscription for a month now. And so you can download as many Magnatune DVDs or CDs, and you can choose the quality and stuff. So I think that they're going to play around with these models. And I think the other thing that's interesting about Magnatune, or there's another service called Purple that I've used, is that they're also promising a better deal for artists. So 50% of all of the costs that you pay go to the artists. And I think for a lot of people who have been a little bit upset about how the music industry has, you know, said that they're supporting artists, but artists sometimes are saying, well, actually, the music industry is not our best friend. They want to support artists. I think music listeners, people who do love music, want to make sure that the money goes to pay the musicians and doesn't necessarily go to pay for promotion of big name acts.
Well, you can read all of our coverage on these music services, including more from Steve Purdom at last month's Guardian Changing Media Summit at guardian.co.uk. Now, here's Jemima with the news.
Apple claims it sold 300,000 iPads on launch day in the US on Saturday, with 1 million apps and 250,000 e-books downloaded in the first 24 hours. Despite the scepticism of some of the tech community, the iPad has received positive reviews and pushed Apple's stock price up by $40 billion in 1 month. Microsoft is set to reveal its first mobile handsets on Monday, a departure from its previous strategy of focusing on the software. Dubbed Project Pink, the smartphones will target social networking and will link to Microsoft's content services such as music. Announcement of the UK's general election on the 6th of May has pushed the Digital Economy Bill up the agenda again, with campaigners including the Open Rights Group demanding the proposals are properly scrutinised. The bill includes controversial methods for dealing with copyright infringement that, amongst other things, could cause problems for companies hosting public Wi-Fi networks. And it's all change at Digg, where Chief Executive Jay Adelson is leaving after 5 years to be replaced by founder Kevin Rose. The move follows rumours of a split between the two and of delays with the imminent fourth version of the site, which Rose apparently wants to overhaul.
Thanks, Jemima. Well, you can read up on all the latest headlines throughout the week at guardian.co.uk/technology.
This is Keith Stewart from the Guardian Games blog. I'm standing outside the computing faculty at Huddersfield University. Inside there are 60 students competing in the X48 Game Camp, which is a game development competition sponsored by and semi-arranged by Microsoft. Inside there are teams of students who have about 24 hours to each create a whole video game around a certain theme. The theme is Giants. I think it's inspired by Huddersfield's Giants rugby team. But anyway, what I'm here to do is get an idea of how on earth you create a whole video game in 24 hours with a team of about 3 students. So let's go in and meet everybody. I'm here with Toby Barnes, the Managing Director of Pixel Lab, who are organising the event. Toby, can you just tell us what is a game jam?
In simple terms, a game jam is a short period of time, usually 48 hours or less, which people have to make a game from scratch.
So is it usually students that are involved, or how does it usually work?
It's often students, or what we call new starts, people who have just graduated, people who are desperate to get in the industry, or very early people who are just learning and like to play with game design.
So how do these games compare to games you may see on a PS3 or Xbox?
A lot of these games aren't as pretty as you might see on a PlayStation or as on an Xbox, but they are They're just as interesting. A lot of the time that people do use sets that can be downloaded, all the sounds, the libraries of sounds and things, but most of the focus of the games is the game design, is how they play, are they fun, rather than lots of explosions and lots of enemies.
What's the atmosphere like? You know, if you get to, say, 2 o'clock in the morning and everyone's maybe getting a little bit tired, what's the atmosphere like? I mean, is it an exciting atmosphere? Are there any kind of big rows? How does it usually play out?
Last time someone said it's a bit like a festival, and the ups and downs of a festival. So usually very early on there's a lot of excitement, a lot of running around, a lot of happy smiley faces. But by 2 o'clock often there can be trouble. Last year we had to pull apart a couple of team of guys that were really struggling, had creative differences. But they calmed down, they got it together, and they produced something brand new and very exciting by the end of it. But there are a lot of tired faces the first thing in the morning.
At 1:30 on Friday afternoon, I decided it was time to take a look at what the teams were working on. So I spoke to Edwin, a student from Nottingham Trent University, whose team was called Team Awesome. So I was expecting something rather amazing.
Our idea is you start as this rogue asteroid from another dimension, and you come into the orbit around a small terrestrial planet, and you become one of the moons, and your job is to orbit around that planet, eating the other moons, so you become sufficient size to start eating the planets. When you're big enough, you start eating the suns. And your goal is to become bigger than VY Canis Majoris, the biggest sun in the universe.
Okay.
And once you do that, you become basically ruler of the universe.
And are you confident that you can do this rather ambitious project in 24 hours?
We are very confident. In fact, we believe we are quite far ahead compared to some teams.
At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I cornered Andy Southers, a development evangelist at Microsoft, who told me what the company hoped to get out of GameCamp.
The first thing is very personal for the participants here, and we're hoping that they can use their time to build games that will help land them a great job in the industry, and we want them to showcase their skill. But secondly, we're hoping that these guys will be inspirational for other students, and not just students in university at the moment, but maybe that next generation in schools at the moment can start to see that real students, not much older than them, can get success with technology.
Do you think a lot of these students are going to come out of things like Game Camp with real strengths that they might not have got from just a pure computing course?
What they're getting out of it is the opportunity to work in teams with people that they don't necessarily know very well, who have very different roles in producing the final game. And also the time pressure works very well for them because it constrains them to what's possible, and they have to focus very much on getting the game produced rather than worrying about adding unnecessary graphics or flash to the game. So it's quite a good grounding in real-world scenarios for them.
So we're just running through into the main hall. The pizzas have arrived. I think about 70 pizzas have turned up, and I think there's going to be an announcement.
Everybody, pizza's ready. If you go through to the room to your right, I see people already running, so be quick.
I've never seen a room full of coders run so fast. It's chaos. It's now 10 to 10 on Friday night, and I'm here with Team Birthday Cake, speaking to Josh, one of the designers on the project. Can you just explain, actually, the game to me once more?
It's a two-player, multiplayer game from 2 to 4 players, and you've got to take your main demigod person and collect a load of followers. The main aim is to get more followers than your opposite player, and the main mechanic of the game is a sequence button game. At the moment, a series of buttons will come up and you'll hit them in succession to gain more of a following from the little guys in the game. So far, we're keeping on target with it, and if it all goes well, we'll add more and more stuff in.
The organisers of the event have arranged for some mentors from the game's development community to come along and talk to each of the teams and find out what you're doing and maybe give you some ideas about what you should be doing. You've seen a couple of the mentors, I believe, already. Can you just give me an idea of what they were saying and maybe some of the ideas that they gave to you?
Well, the main topic of conversation with the mentors was the button sequence mechanic of the game. Being, obviously, some people are going to be better at hitting buttons and know the controller more than other people. So we thought the best way to do it is to let the gamers choose how they want to win by giving them many different routes of gameplay to get to the same end of the game.
That's why you don't let Jay explain stuff. No.
What did I say that didn't make sense?
Pretty much everything.
The teams were just settling into a night of relentless coding when potential catastrophe struck. Every night the PCs in the lab automatically shut down and restart, but no one had hit the override button.
So there was a rush of explosive activity as all the game files were quickly saved. Then everyone waited with bated breath as the computers restarted. Luckily, it was all saved and everything was okay. An hour later, with the crisis averted, I was keen to find out more about the psychology of all-night games programming. So I spoke to Oscar Mullen, a student from the University of Huddersfield who was at the game camp last year and was helping out this year. He told me a little bit about what was going through people's minds at this hour in the morning.
Snacks are now available downstairs. Go and get your energy drinks while they're still there.
You start weighing up whether sleep is good for you or sleep is bad for you, because you could go to sleep, come back and feel a lot worse for it, or you could go to sleep, come back and feel refreshed by it, in which case you're a benefit to your team. So it is, you spend ages thinking about, do I sleep, do I not sleep? And it ends up wearing on your mind constantly to the point where you can't even work, because you can't decide what is best for everybody. So it's given a couple more hours.
Hamlet-esque dilemma, to sleep or not to sleep, that is the question.
That is the question.
It's now Saturday morning. The judges have been going around and talking to all the contestants and giving them a few kind of pieces of valuable input into their games. And now the judges are going back to a small meeting room just behind the main programming hall. And they've just started to talk about some of the games that they like. So let's see what the judges are saying.
I think at the moment with that game, what I would say is either make your start size a little bit bigger so there's more things that you can eat for early on. And actually then, rather than just the kind of random scattering, which is what they've done, actually have things that are smaller and easier to eat and more of them close in.
They've got a problem, which is they've got a time problem, which is right now they've got this, it's kind of a 10-20 second experience a level.
Yeah.
And they're kind of trying to get all this deep strategy in there. And it's like you don't have time. All you've got time to do is collect the red dots.
So there's 15 seconds left to go now. Everyone's really, well, completely finished. Everyone's standing up around their computers, just kind of chatting away. I am still awake, still here. I had an hour and a half sleep, and here we go.
Right, finish. Keyboards down. We'll get the top three. So get yourself moving, and we'll see you in a minute. The first prize goes to Arrogant Incas.
I'm here with the winners of the X48 game camp in Huddersfield. It's Team Birthday Cake. What do you think it was that you think you got completely right?
We thought it through quite carefully to begin with before we really began the game, and we spent quite a lot of time, well, not a mass amount of time, but we spent a good amount of time actually working through the gameplay and how it would work and why it would be fun.
We took in a lot of feedback from different mentors as well. A lot of mentors were quite interested in giving us their opinion, so we took that on board as well.
The only tip I can say for anyone who wants to compete later is keep your game simple, really real simple idea, and refine it and build on top of that, because if you get too big of an idea, then you're not going to complete it.
Okay, well, congratulations. Well done.
Thank you.
Congratulations to Team Birthday Cake with Arrogant Incas. And many thanks to Keith Stewart for working so diligently and tirelessly for 8,000 solid hours to bring us that report. Though, to be fair, he does have a young family, so he should be used to it. Bobby, are events like the X48 Game Camp the future of game development?
Oh, I think we've certainly seen a lot of this sort of event taking place and a lot more of this sort of open collaboration happening. And part, you know, it's for a number of reasons. It's easier to do. People are more open now. But I think also there's just a sense that you get more from sharing ideas than you get by hoarding them. And you can experiment and you can do the sort of more creative, less constrained things than you might be able to do in the office or in your studio or, you know, or with the people you work with every day. And I mean, that's got to be a good thing, really. It's got to help the industry and gamers at the end of the day.
Kevin, this camp structure has been very, very useful in the web space, hasn't it? We've seen it for things like social innovations. We've seen it for all types of things. Why has it worked so well in web technologies?
Well, I think, we've even seen it recently with things like e-government. So The Guardian recently hosted Rewired State here. I think one of the things that it does is when you've got a deadline of 24 hours or 48 hours and you just kind of say, it focuses the mind. And I think, you know, in it shows what is possible and what's not possible in 48 hours. But it's interesting. And also, I think that competitive environment also sort of eggs people on. You know, and it grew up out of this unconference bar camp type structure. But it may seem slightly chaotic to people on the outside. But for some reason, it delivers results.
Well, I'd like to point out that game camp did not break any molds with the participants based upon the pictures that I saw on the website. And it is a very good website. It was all boys. There was not a single lady in game camp at all. And all they ate was pizza and all they drank was sugar high energy drinks. So, you know, I'd like to see a girls game jam or something like that. See what came out of that. Perhaps on an Ada Lovelace day next year or in the future. But do let us know if you know anything about anything out there that fits that bill, you know, a girl game camp or whatever, on Twitter. You can get in touch with us there at GuardianTW, or you can send us an email, traditional means, or get in touch via the blog. Head over to guardian.co.uk/techweekly for all the details. That's all from us this week, a podcast that has literally featured everyone on the Tech Weekly team: Charles, Keith, Jemima, Kevin, and Bobby. Thanks to our guests, Steve Purdom and the folks in Huddersfield at the XNA Game Camp. And how can we forget Scott Colley, our producer? Now, before we go, I thought we'd spend a few moments looking back at Bobby's finest moments in the pod. This one's for you, Bob.
Operating system aside, this is the service I wanted anyway. If I'm sitting visiting the iPlayer site, it means I'm oh, fucking hell.
You
I can't read my
so
writing.
I've
come back with, you know, with a nuclear bomb and a condom, and then I thought that just sounded really wrong.
So next week I'm passing the baton to the rest of the Games Blog crew. Oh, nutsack.
Bobby, have you been Olympicking?
I watched some of the opening ceremony on Friday last week. I was fucking fantastic.
It was, yeah, pretty
I was thinking, how far should I go? I should go quite a long way.
Ooh, I can't say that, can I? As the man at the top of one of the world's biggest technology companies, Nvidia chief Jensen, I knew I'd get that wrong. I've been thinking about it too much. And if that's tickled your taste buds, you can find out more about the Nethernet by visiting thenethernet.com. Now for a change of pace, it's time to hear
Pat.
She's climbing around in cardboard boxes we're packing up in. Ugh. Right, I'll do that in bit again.
I'm leaving for Las Vegas
for the consumer.
Is this just for gambling and hookers?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Bit of cocaine, bit of prostitution.
What are you actually going to do any work?
It's actually the Consumer Electronics Show, which is the biggest. Oh, they're all laughing now. The mental image is too much for them. Also, they've changed the rules slightly for the certification of games. So the BBFC, who are the British censors, now have a slightly wider remit on what games get what ratings. Oh, yeah, I've got to ask a question. I forgot. Okay, cat. Oh, it's the other cat. This one's bigger. Oh, bloody hell. She's just sat there. Okay. Oh, well. Thanks for that, squirrel. Good work. Come on.
Yeah, well, you know, you did have to learn about your forebears, you being too young to remember the BBC Micro Minutes.
I'm still in nappies.
We don't want to know about that.
No, now. Oh, no, that's worse. Sorry. Yes, let's carry on. Move yeah. along swiftly.
What was that about internet memes?
I'm glad I'm doing this again. It sounds rubbish to me.
And finally, archaeologists believe they have solved the mysterious death of Otzi, the famous 5,000-year-old mummified iceman from Austria. Until now, nobody knew what killed the chilly chap. But new analysis has revealed that he bled to death after
Who wrote this?
I did. I just wanted to call him a chilly chap. What's wrong with that?
Well, dear.
I thought it would be amusing, and it was.
Is, yeah.
Unfortunately, now I can't stop laughing.
Very funny.
And finally, archaeologists believe they've solved the mysterious death of Otzi, the famous 5,000-year-old mummified iceman. Until now, nobody knew what killed the chilly chap. Okay.
Come on, run that. We can't. It's not going to. We're not going to make it.
No, no.
I shall try going through this again in a booming Shakespearean voice. Yes.
Ah.
I try again. I do it right this time. I will, I promise.
Always the consummate professional. We're sorry to see you go. Now, Kevin, actually, you are in fact a true professional because we don't have a single bit of dirt on you.
And oh, no.
I know. We were digging and we're sorry to see that you're going before we can actually dig up any dirt on you. So good luck to you in your future endeavours and to you as well, Bobby. We will miss both of you dearly.
Well, thanks. I mean, all I can really say is that it's been an honour and a privilege. I was going to say that I'd be glad to see the back of all of you, but to be honest, I'll miss you all terribly, and that includes the listeners as well as the as you guys in the studio. But you know, whatever I get up to next, I'm sure I'll drop in and keep in touch and let you know what's going on. So goodbye from me.
In the meantime, I'll be back with our regular service next week. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this one's for you, Bobby. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.